Chapter 22. Oxford, March 1930. 3 months into the new year, and 4 months since Alice returned to England, and still no word from her. Tom feels his hope dwindling. He thinks of that last afternoon, and of the night that followed. She had been uncharacteristically shy with him the next day, but that was understandable. It was, as she had told him, the first time she'd done anything quite like that. There had been no coolness in her manner afterwards, and yet here it is, the incontrovertible fact that she seems to have forgotten, or chosen to forget, that he exists. Maybe they did make a mistake that night, though he could never bring himself to see it as such. Or perhaps things could have been different had she not met that self-satisfied Frenchman she wrote about in her letters, or if Tom had been able to make his way out to Venice, as she had suggested. He is tormented by the idea that his own lack of action may have cost him so much. The one thing equal to distracting himself from these thoughts is his art. The small exhibition that he wrote to tell Alice about was a success. Where most of those represented had just one piece in the show, Tom, much to his astonishment, had eight. There had been coverage, too, in a couple of local papers and the university journals. It was the first time since that trip to see Lady Margaret that he felt he might have a chance at it. Tom goes for an early morning stroll along Addison's Walk to clear his mind. At this hour, a month ago, it would have been dark, but this morning the college and its grounds are washed in the thin grey light of dawn. Daffodils, trumpets still furled into tight knots, and primroses, with preternaturally bright petals, line the path. Spring usually brings thoughts of regeneration, of hope. This year, however, it serves only to remind Tom of how much time has passed without word from her, and of how much closer he is to having to make decisions about his future that he would rather postpone. A little more time, that is all he needs. Time to travel farther down that path on which his recent work has taken him. But each month seems to pass more quickly than the one before it. Soon he will be out in the world with his new responsibilities and the weight of his parents' expectations. Tom likes this route along the walk because of the sense of his own smallness it inspires, the sense that he is following in the footsteps of men far greater than he could ever hope to be. Usually he would take his time, but the wind is getting up, driving the rain sideways, assaulting him through his thin jacket, so he turns back in the direction of the college building, preparing himself for the daily ritual of asking at the porter's lodge if there are any telegrams. Afterwards, he will head to his cubbyhole to check for the letter that never comes. As he nears the lodge, he thinks, "Perhaps I'll wait. I'll go after breakfast." Disappointment, even the sort that has become habitual, sits badly on an empty stomach. Yes, he decides, it can wait. Yet as he passes the lodge, he hears his name called from within.
"Mrs. Stafford, is that you?"
He peers inside.
"Thought it was. Here's a message for you. The one day you don't come and ask."
Tom steps forward. He is careful to appear disinterested. It could, after all, be nothing. A message from his mother, perhaps, always welcome, but no cause for unnecessary excitement. The man hands him a slip of paper, and he stands in the doorway to read it.
"Dear Thomas, stop. Would appreciate your assistance in a matter close to both of our hearts, stop. If you can spare the time, please take train to London immediately, and all expenses will be reimbursed, stop. Yours, M."
M. It is from Lady Margaret. He is in no doubt. There is the meeting with his tutor this evening. There is the deadline for the paper at the end of the week. Nevertheless, he goes to his room and packs a bag with the few things that present themselves to him as necessary for the trip. His sketchbook and leather pencil case, a couple of books too, though more out of a sense of duty than any real belief that he will study on his journey down. On the train, as the waterlogged countryside slides unremarked past his window, he takes the telegram from his pocket and studies it again. It's about Alice. He knows it is. He tries to extract some further meaning. Is Alice in trouble? How, he thinks, could he have been so self-absorbed as to ignore the possibility that something might have happened to her? Lady Margaret answers the door herself. She is attired no less eccentrically than the last time Tom set eyes on her. A long housecoat in plum velvet with dragons and birds and exotic flora embroidered on the chest and sleeves.
a scarf of fuchsia pink silk about her head in aggressive contrast with her tangerine hair. She uses a different staff today, with a silver jackal's head for a handle, the pointed face peering cheekily from beneath her grasp. He realizes, standing in front of her, that she is not as tall as he had imagined. It is rather the effect of her presence, and the etiolated slenderness that lend the impression of height. "Thomas," she says, with no reference to the journey he has made, as though his arrival on her doorstep is a given thing. "Welcome. I need your help." She beckons him through to the salon, and he sits on an emerald ottoman with feet like the claws of a bird of prey. Beatrice enters immediately, bearing a tall silver flask of coffee, which she pours from an impressive height into two cups. "Is Alice all right?" Tom asks, unable to bear not knowing any longer. Lady Margaret reaches behind her, takes a small wooden box from the top of the cabinet, and withdraws two slender cigars, proffering one, which Tom declines. She lights the other for herself and draws upon it thoughtfully before she speaks. "You see, that's the thing. I haven't heard from her since she left Venice. I was rather hoping she might have been in contact with you." He shakes his head, and she sighs forth a cloud of peat-scented smoke. "I assumed that she was too, well, busy," he says. "The last letter I had from her was sent from Venice in late October." "Ah, I was hoping you wouldn't say that. So she's had no contact with either of us. I'm afraid there's something strange going on, and I feel certain it's Georgina's doing. I have never trusted that woman." She draws on the cigar, the tip flaming dangerously, and exhales again. "My brother was the impulsive sort. Most of his impulses were true, but he cannot have made a worse decision in his life than to marry Georgina. She is a bourgeois, a Philistine, and worst of all, she cannot bear the fact that she has failed to make a daughter in her own dismal image." She squints at him through the smoke. "I wonder if anything got back to her." "What do you mean?" "Venice. There was," and here she looks at Tom apologetically, "someone who took an interest in Alice. He was older, had been around the world a little. I thought it would be good for her to see some of the city with him, an education of sorts." "I know," Tom says, his ears ringing with the concentrated effort of remaining impassive. "She mentioned him in a letter." Lady Margaret nods. "Once," she says, "when Alice had just turned 16, I told Georgina that I would arrange to meet her from school at the end of term. Instead of taking her home, I whisked her off to Paris, and we spent a long weekend there. Her mother retaliated by sending her to that place in Switzerland for 3 years. And you think that if she has found out about Venice, she might do something similar?" "I don't know, but I don't like it. I had Jacob drive me to the house the other day, and it all seemed too quiet. I knocked on the door, and the butler was very abrupt. No, the family weren't there. Where had they gone? He wouldn't say." She thinks for a moment. "Though it might not have been true. Have you seen that house?" "No. It is like a fortress. If they didn't want anyone coming in or going out, they could pull up the drawbridge easily enough. I'm on the blacklist. Oh, ne passez pas." Lady Margaret regards Tom thoughtfully. "But they don't know you, do they?" Alice's house is exactly as Lady Margaret described it, the modern equivalent of a fortress. The stucco facade is a natural partner for the pewter of the sky, and to Tom it resembles a great plaster cast concealing possible deformities beneath. He stares up at the secret squares of the dark windows, and is reminded irresistibly of the photographs he has seen of Alice's stepfather, with his large square head and the small eyes set slightly too close together in the broad expanse of his skull. For all this, he and the house are handsome, in an order in which handsomeness is equated with a projection of power, authority, and utter conviction. The lofty door, painted dark grey, makes Tom think of drawbridges. He knocks. After several long moments, it swings open to reveal an elderly butler. The man insinuates himself into the space between door and frame so as to block the view to within, and peers down at the visitor. "Can I help you, sir?" he says, but his tone suggests that no assistance will be forthcoming. "I hope so. I'm a friend of Alice's." The butler blinks at him impassively.
Lady Alice isn't at home, sir.
Oh, where is she, if you don't mind me asking?
It isn't my place to say, sir.
But something in Tom's expression goes some way to softening the old man. As though he feels it is against his better judgment, the butler leans forward and murmurs,
Lady Alice has been unwell. My mistress, Lady Hexford, thought it best that she be removed to the country to recuperate.
The country?
Indeed, sir.
May I ask the nature of Lady Alice's illness?
I'm afraid I am not at liberty to say, sir.
But is it serious?
Tom thinks of the flu that killed his mother's sister and several cousins in 1918.
I must insist, sir, on you asking me no more about it. I have told you everything that I...
A voice comes from within.
Is this fellow bothering you, Simpson?
The speaker appears, a youngish man in his 30s perhaps, shorter than Tom but powerfully built, with a large, handsome face and a pugnacious set to his jaw. This must be Matthew, the stepbrother.
Not exactly, sir. He was... You know, old chap,
Matthew says to Tom, I think I have something of yours here.
Oh?
He pulls them from his pocket. It is a moment before Tom recognizes them for what they are. His last letters to Alice.
As my sister is indisposed, I decided it would be best if I attended to her correspondence,
Matthew says, as though it is explanation enough.
Those were private.
Ah, I thought you might say that.
I assure you, my sister would understand entirely.
No, she'd positively want me to have opened them. We're extremely close, you see.
Tom turns to go. There is nothing to be done here, and he refuses to waste time on this foul character. The letters have given him new cause for alarm.
By the way, old chap.
Yes?
Tom manages to keep his tone civil.
You know, if I've got one piece of wisdom, it's this.
Matthew glances at the letters, and then up at Tom, a smile playing about his lips.
I really would advise against all this sentiment. It's not going to work with my sister. If you want to get between her legs, try being less subtle about it. She's a woman of the world, my sister. She'll understand plain speaking far better.
Tom doesn't stop to think. He turns and lunges for the man, not caring where he is or who he is, not someone brought up to brawl in the streets. All he wants is to inflict the maximum degree of pain possible, preferably a direct hit to that smirking face. But his fist collides with wood instead of flesh, and his knuckles smart with the impact. It takes him a good few seconds to work out that the door has been slammed in his face. The car is a different vehicle from the one Alice drove on those autumn afternoons in Oxfordshire. It is dark grey and huge, if possible, even larger than the other. It holds comfortably the driver, Liverweight, a hamper of food, just in case, Lady Margaret, Tom, and Lady Margaret's Burmese cat, William, who sits imperiously upon his own cushion between them. Chebworth is hardly more than a hamlet, a scattering of cottages and an inn, and Chebworth Manor lies a couple of miles from the village. It does not reveal itself until they are directly before it, for the grounds are shrouded with a dark thicket of elm and oak, so that it is impossible to see beyond them to the house. They draw to a halt in front of the ironwork gates that mark the entrance to the drive, and through the opening a vast building can be glimpsed. The car idles. Lady Margaret looks across at Tom.
You should go in alone.
Tom is astonished that this fearless woman appears to be showing something like cowardice. As if reading his thoughts, Lady Margaret gives a bark of laughter.
Oh, I'm not afraid of her, if that's what you think. I'm only concerned that my presence might complicate matters. I seem... unable to behave myself, you see, when I'm in her presence. I think it might be safer if it were just you.
The gates are secured with a padlock and chain, but Tom has been adept since childhood in the scaling of difficult ascents. Various species of tree, the low cliffs around Wynard Cove, the drop beneath the dormitory window at school. Lady Margaret, Liverweight, and William look on as he scrambles his way up and over the wall to drop down into the damp, dark thicket below. Wet vegetation, branches and leaves, claw at him as he fights his way through the undergrowth to the expanse of lawn. The grass is short and soft as green velvet, as immaculate as if it had been clipped with a pair of nail scissors. The gravel drive stretches away on his right towards the house. The building in the distance looks less like a home than a state building. It is squat and white. For all its pretensions to grandeur, it looks like the giant white plinth of some missing statue. The many windows glitter uniformly in the weak sun. It takes Tom a good 15 minutes to walk the length of the drive to the front door. The building stares down upon him, impassive yet watchful, like some resting beast. The door creaks open before he has even reached the first step, and another butler emerges, older than Simpson, with a shock of white hair, a more pronounced sag to the shoulders. It is the same story, give or take a few words. Lady Alice is unwell and not receiving visitors. In what way is she unwell? The butler looks at Tom as if he has committed an act of gross indecency and informs him that he
is not at liberty to say, sir.
I'm a friend, Tom says, reasonably, and I'm concerned for her.
Nevertheless, sir, the man begins closing the door. Nevertheless, I'm afraid that I must ask you to leave.
My name is Thomas Stafford. His voice is almost a shout now, despite his efforts to stay calm. Will you at least let her know that I called? The butler makes a quick motion of his head that could be a shake or nod, impossible to say. Then the door closes, surprisingly quietly for something so large, with a tiny click. Tom stands there, his whole being taut with frustration. In the emerald silence of the grounds, the pounding of his blood in his ears is deafeningly loud. He lingers for a minute or so, considering his options. As stealthily as possible, Tom makes his way round the side of the house, searching for another entrance. At the back of the building, he comes upon a low annex, which a clamour of metal and belch of savoury steam reveal to be the kitchens. Almost without thinking, he makes for the door. As he reaches it, it swings open and a figure emerges. Alice! She hurries towards him, pulling her coat about her. It is a man's trench coat, and her bare knees beneath its hem appear pale and naked in the cold glare of the day. She looks far from ill, Tom thinks, and yet there is a change in her appearance, though it is difficult to determine exactly what. She seems softer. There is an unusual rosiness to her cheeks, too, not, Tom decides, the unhealthy flush of the invalid.
Let's walk, shall we?
She takes his arm, and he feels her warm against his side.
Look, Alice, he says, trying to remind himself that he is angry with her. What's the game? I haven't heard from you for months. We were worried about you.
We?
Your aunt and I.
I'll explain everything, once we're properly alone.
She leads the way through a gate into the walled kitchen gardens, and they make for a stone love seat at the far end.
We can't be seen from the house in here, she says, though it may be already too late for that. You made quite a racket, you know.
Are you surprised? They said you were ill, but wouldn't say what was wrong or how bad. It was as if you'd been locked away.
There is sunlight now, though a weak and trembling sort. The stone is cold beneath them, and the dew-wet grass about them exhales a shimmering mist of moisture into the air. Tom looks at Alice, her pink knees, her muzzed hair, and forgives her everything. The long silence, the worry she has caused him. Sitting here beside her in this garden of enchantment, with spring suddenly upon them, it all seems to make sense. Then Alice speaks in a voice unfamiliar to him.
The thing is, she says quietly and slowly, choosing the words carefully. The thing is, I've been rather a fool.
She looks down at her hands, as though she might read her next lines there. He waits for her to continue. He has never seen Alice like this. In this moment, they are so silent and still that a magpie struts its way past their feet, unperturbed by their presence. Alice twists her fingers together. A slow flush creeps up the side of her face, and she refuses to look up and meet his gaze. Finally, she says,
I don't think there's a way of dressing this up. Oh, Tom, the thing is, you see, I'm going to have a baby.
He cannot speak. Alice gives a strange, humorless laugh. It is a shocking sound in the silence of the garden. The magpie screeches and takes flight. Instantly, Tom is making calculations, weighing options. He'll go into the law after all. He'll make a home for them, support Alice and the child. But when he looks back up at her, ready to say all of this,
he sees that she is shaking her head.
"I don't understand," he says.
She still won't look at him. "It wasn't you, Tom. When I was in Venice..." She stops when she sees the look on his face. He cannot hear any more. He thinks of the things he could say now that would leave him anatomized before her. "It was my maid in London," Alice tells him. "She saw all the signs even before I did. She must have reported it back to Mother."
"What are you going to do? You can't want to stay here like this."
"No," she says. "No, I don't."
"Then why?"
"I'm going to play along with her game, Tom. She wants me here, hiding myself away." She gestures down at herself, and Tom sees now that the curve of her belly is visible beneath the loose folds of the coat. "I'm in no fit state to do anything at the moment. This is the best place for me, until I can work out what to do."
"You could come and live with me."
"No, Tom."
"But I could look after you both."
She shakes her head again.
"You aren't going to him, surely?"
"To whom?" She looks at him in confusion, and then understanding. "Oh, no, no, of course not. I'll do this on my own."
"Where will you go? How will you live?"
"We'll manage." Then she smiles, almost like the Alice of old. "Do you know, I wonder whether that sense I had of needing to do something meaningful, to make something of my life, well, I wonder if it was this all along."
He tries one last time. "Alice, please, let me help you. You can't stay here. Come with your aunt and me. She's waiting in the car at the gate."
Alice reaches up with her free hand and touches the side of his cheek lightly. He closes his eyes. "You're so very wonderful, which is why I would never think of coming with you. I will not be your responsibility. But you should leave, Tom." She says it gently, but this only makes her words all the more terrible.
"When will I see you?"
She leans over and kisses him on the cheek, and he breathes the familiar scent of her skin. "Not for a while, I think." Returning the way he came, towards the waiting car just visible beyond the gates, Tom turns once. Alice has disappeared inside. The house stares blindly as before, but then he catches a flutter of movement in one of the upstairs windows. He thinks he glimpses a white face gazing down upon him, then a flash, like the scales of a fish turning over in the sunlight, of pale blonde hair. Back in his room in Oxford, Tom lets his bag fall to the floor. He can feel a great pressure building inside him, pressing itself against his ribcage, a feeling that is more akin to grief than to rage, but easily as powerful and destructive. He looks about him wildly. In the corner of the room he sees the wooden chest, the one in which he keeps all of his painting supplies. As though driven by some influence beyond thought, he strides over to it and unlocks it, begins pulling it all out, paint, brushes, putties and pencils, letting them scatter across the floorboards. A couple of the tins of oils burst their lids and begin to shed their bright contents. Tom doesn't notice. His attention is solely on the task at hand. He pays no heed when he snags the skin of his thumb on a scalpel and the blood begins to flow freely. The sharp pain, so much more manageable than the pain inside, merely aids his single-minded focus. He does not pause until the chest is empty. The studies of Alice are the only pieces that he has allowed to face outwards, the only works of which he has, up until this point, felt truly proud. This makes them easy to find in this small space, though they are many. Tom takes them up, every one. Into the chest they go, all of them. He forces those that will not fit properly, hearing as he does the crack of wood and the unmistakable sound of ripping canvas. The sound is oddly gratifying. His eyes burn, not with tears, but with the terrible, aching absence of them. He shuts the chest, wrenching the lid down and forcing the clasps into place. He takes the key and locks it. Only now does he reach for the whiskey kept in his cupboard. He rarely drinks the stuff, and the bottle is 3/4 full. It should be enough, he hopes, to take away some of the pain. In the shifting, queasy darkness, Tom wakes from his stupor and sways across the floor to the chest, lit by the cold, weak light from the quad. He opens it quickly
as though something might escape, and removes the drawing, the one of Alice by the lake. He knows the size and shape of it without looking. He is unable, he realizes, to bear the thought of it shut away in the dark. Then he rams the lid down, hard.